few decades, Muslims in the West and elsewhere have allied with leftist movements in the struggle against war, imperialism and racism, among other just causes. But on today's show, we're going to ask how far should these alliances go and could they dilute authentic Islamic activism? Before we get into the discussion, let's take a look at the context to this story.
In recent years, Muslim activism in the Western world has found a home for itself in the political left. As a minority, Muslims in America and Europe routinely face discrimination, racism, and Islamophobia, sometimes institutional, sometimes on a street level. So naturally, many Muslims began working alongside anti-racism, anti-establishment groups, pushing for better quality for the less privileged. But it was the West's war on terror and the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan which truly forced Western Muslims into the arms of a thriving left-wing-led anti-war movement, condemning imperialism in all its forms.
How many years will it take the world to put this right?
Historically, however, Islam and left-wing politics have been at odds. The former USSR caused wide upset across the Ummah for supporting secularism in the Arab world and for the later invasion of Afghanistan. Communism, too, is a political ideology infamous for its hostility to all religion, routinely described as an atheist movement. The left, in general, remains popular with many atheists. In more recent times, Western Muslims who pursue political careers are routinely condemned for abandoning Islamic principles to seemingly fit in with left-wing party politics. America's Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, UK Labour's Sadiq Khan and Zara Sultana, and Scotland's Hamza Yousaf remain prominent examples of left-wing Muslims who have received criticism from their own community. Popular causes associated to the left include the LGBT cause, radical feminism, trans activism, atheism and wokeism, concepts which are at odds with Islam. How Muslims can balance this relationship and remain loyal to their religious obligations is becoming an increasingly important debate amid a growing culture war.
Joining us today to talk about the left in the UK, we have Amar Kazmi, who is an anti-imperialist political activist who's recently finished a master's degree in human rights law. He previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and later worked in the UK Parliament. Also joining us today, we have Mizan Rahman, also known as Mizan the Poet, a British Bengali campaigner and anti-racist activist who specialises in disentangling and disseminating the processes and policies used against oppressed communities in the UK through workshops and articles. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Amar, let me come straight to you. I want to ask you about your experiences with the left. You've been very active in left-wing circles for quite some time now, but right now I think that there's a kind of issue where a lot of Muslims feel, you know, like they're politically homeless and even persecuted in some cases in the left here in the UK specifically. Just tell me, what's your experience has been like?
Well, I was a member of the Labour Party for 6 years during the Corbyn period and just the first year, I think, year and a half of Keir Starmer's leadership. So it was a time of great political struggle. I think lots of Muslims allied themselves with Jeremy Corbyn and saw an avenue to support issues that are important to Muslims like Palestine through and under his leadership. But I found that the left in general seems to have a problem with practicing Muslims. And that's not often understood because, you know, from the left's perspective, they would perceive themselves to be on our side, to be with us. They support, you know, the underdog, they're anti-racists. And actually, I found that that's kind of an aesthetic thing. They seem to enjoy having Muslims to, you know, support a coalition of the oppressed, if you like. You know, of course, there was a time, you know, about 20 years ago when the left supported Muslims in terms of opposing the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and during the war on terror. But at that point in time, anti-imperialism, a genuine anti-imperialism, I think, was something that really existed on the left. Now that's been smashed as a result of propaganda campaigns and the successful work, in my view, of Western intelligence agencies. And we find now, in this current juncture, Muslims, practicing Muslims, tend to be quite unwelcome in these leftist spaces when they express views that support things like Islamic resistance, Islamic anti-imperialism, Muslim views on anti-enlightenment understandings of sexuality, for example. And I find that the more de-Islamized or non-Muslim you are, the more Muslim in name you are, the more welcome you are on the left, the more you're open, you're welcome, sorry, into different spaces. So that's what I found. I found that there's a contradiction between what the left says and how it actually approaches and welcomes practicing Muslims within its ranks.
You've said some really interesting stuff there, which I'm going to go into a bit more so shortly, but I want to bring Mirzan in on this. Mirzan, just tell me, what's your experiences been like? You, again, have been involved in left-wing politics here in the UK and have been very active in the past. How was your experience?
I think generally I've been treated okay. My views and my religious beliefs have been widely respected by my friends and comrades within the left. So generally my experiences have been okay with the organizations that I'm already part of. I am aware that that's not been the case for everyone, but for me it's been, I've been pretty comfortable. Obviously internally there may be discussions that we have had in regards to philosophical views, religious views, but they've always been done in a very comradely manner, not in a very confrontational manner. I felt as though my views have been respected, even though, people who are within the same organization might have opposing views. But at the same time, it depends on what you're standing on. If it goes against our religious beliefs, our philosophical and moral beliefs, then obviously we cannot stand in those platforms, make those kind of alliances. But if it is something that doesn't go against what we believe in and something that may be for what we believe in, then I think from my experiences, I've been very welcomed in those spaces. So, I haven't seen an issue with that at the moment.
Thank you. It's very insightful what you've mentioned there. I want to come back to you, Omar, because what you said earlier was really interesting. You have raised the question about whether or not some Muslims are actually even welcome in left-wing politics, particularly conservative, traditionalist, practicing Muslims, basically. Now, I want to explore that a bit more because I know many Muslims, and some of the things they would tell me is that, we get the left on things like anti-war, anti-racism. Of course, they get it as a minority here. They would, especially with the West engaged in wars in Muslim countries and stuff like that. But Islam is actually socially quite conservative in many aspects. So they might even see eye to eye with conservative political parties here in the UK when it comes to things like, support for a marriage setup, being critical of abortions, being critical of, liberal thinking on a lot of social issues. So just tell me what you think on that, because is that the real issue here, the fact that Muslims are socially conservative based on their religious beliefs, but okay, on some issues they can coincide with the left on, say, anti-imperialism and politics, that type of thing?
Well, I think there is certainly, Islam is a, as you say, is a socially conservative religion in many ways. It differs from the left in its understanding. And I think one thing that's very clear is that the left, as well as being unwelcoming of practicums, the reason why it does that, I think, is because in many respects it fails to, one, understand where Islam comes from theologically on some of these issues, such as sexuality, for example, when it comes to LGBT campaigning, that's very much based in their understanding of putting people in different identities and essentially saying that you belong to this identity or that identity. Well, Islam doesn't really have that understanding. Islam thinks about these things in terms of deeds and practices. It doesn't put someone in a tick box identity area because they do one thing or the other. So one is a lack of understanding. I also think that there is, just in general, a lack of strategic thinking and also a lack of genuine support for freedom of expression. You know, we think about the left as supporting these kind of things, but actually it doesn't think about how it wants to build a coalition to take power, to take authority. It doesn't understand in a way that I think some other parts of the left, because I wouldn't put all the left in the same category. If we look at Mick Lynch, who is the general secretary of the RMT union, the Rail Workers Union, he's said that actually we need to be understanding about people who are church-going or mosque-going, and they may run up with problems with people on the left, but we have to understand where they're coming from, respect their beliefs, and try to build a broad coalition. I think many people on the left, on the Western left, have a very intolerant position. They don't seem to understand the need to build coalitions. And I think there are going to be cases, and probably already have been, where they're going to, because they're so extreme on pushing their particular views on these social issues, pushing people who are their natural political allies in so many other areas into the hands of the far right, for example. Mm. So I think that's something that the left needs to really tackle and consider.
Now, Mirzan, let me bring you back in on this. Let me just ask you straight up. Now, I've been associated with some left-wing activism in the past myself. I know very well what you're likely to encounter when dealing with the left. We're talking about things like atheists, staunch atheists. We're talking about people who are against all religion. We're talking about feminism, things, ideologies that might see like the hijab, the niqab, as being blatantly oppressive, and even critics of Islam. You may encounter on the left. So just tell me, how can you justify, as a religious Muslim, engaging and working alongside individuals who may have this type of mindset?
I think where the where our main issue lies is issues to do with LGBTQ and trans and trans rights and all those kind of things. For me, my experience has been is that there are avenues within the left that are open to debate, that there are spaces within the left where you can talk about gender ideology or gender critical kind of, you know, ideas, debate them, contest them. I've always seen the left as a market and as a place of contestation. And I've had my views known about the trans issues. And my views is that we don't agree with kind of vigilante violence, or I don't agree with physical harm or oppression. But at the same time, I won't agree with lifestyles and people's form of behaviour that go against my religious and philosophical beliefs. And I think from where I stand, as long as I've made myself clear where my red lines are, I've been pretty much welcomed and tolerated by some individuals, let's just say.
Well, they have it, Amar. Let me come back on. I want to ask you a very similar question because, you know, to be honest with you, I'm a little bit tired of the left. I think I've reached a stage now where I'm kind of over it. Jeremy Corbyn era has gone. He was very popular with Muslims here in the UK. And I think we look at the wider left-wing world. Any Muslim politician I see who succeeds in left politics, one thing we notice from them that they have in common is that they have clearly been criticised for compromising on their Islamic traditions, on their upbringing, basically. Ilhan Omar, who have we got here? We've got the Muslim London mayor, Sadiq Khan. Hamza Yousaf is even being questioned right now whether he's left the fold of Islam because of his defence of same-gender relationships on camera to journalists. So just tell me, quite frankly, do you think that we actually can, as Muslims, really identify, say, socialists or lefties? Surely there's a big issue here.
Well, I mean, I personally do consider myself to be of the left. I would call myself a socialist. But I think that one has to be very, as a practicing Muslim, be very clear-eyed about these things. One, I think you have to understand the context within which you live, and the context, particularly being in the West, I think is different to being in a leftist in other spaces. You know, we have to understand that in large part, not all of them, but in large part, people who are, let's say, militant atheists or evangelical atheists, their ultimate aim is to acculturate us out of Islam and our belief system. Some of the old school type, the very extreme ones, might even view us as some sort of unreconstructed savages, right? But we have to understand that that is their position. There are some issues with which we can work with them, other issues in which we understand, actually, we don't agree with you on that. And I think we just have to be more confident you know, after two decades of securitization and ideological warfare, intergenerational ideological warfare, particularly targeted at young people, we have to try to recapture an understanding that actually we do have a stake in our societies, and we, you know, if we put ourselves forward strongly and we defend our positions, unlike people like Sadiq Khan or Hamza Yousaf or whatever, I wouldn't say that, you know, the only reason they've reached that position is because they've compromised on their views. They didn't try to... Well, I wouldn't say they tried in the first place to really defend their views, so we don't know what the alternative outcome would have been. People like Hamza Yousaf were very influential, Sadiq Khan. You know, I think they could have tried. They didn't try. So that, I think, is the first step. We need to understand that actually we have a stake. Let's defend our positions. And okay, some people probably will be filtered out of the process. But the only way you move the needle forward is if everyone contributes to that effort. The business of politics is the business of normalizing beliefs.
But with that's what we have to do. With that way of thinking, surely that means that, well, for example, we could work toe-to-toe with some right-wing thinkers because they have conservative views. I don't know, like Tommy Robinson, for example, a notorious Islamophobe, has recently said things which perhaps Muslims might agree with. He's a notorious Islamophobe, for anyone who doesn't know. But, I mean, that way of thinking, OK, let's work with the left. We know they don't like us on these issues, but let's work with them. Well, that could be applied to anyone. Why is it that we're working with the left and we're not working with the far right even?
Well,
they're conservative.
Well, I would say that actually we should be broader in terms of who we're working. That should include people on the right. I wouldn't include people like Tommy Robinson or Stephen Yaxley-Lennon is his actual name, of course, who, as you say, is a notorious Islamophobe, is a fascist. We shouldn't be working with those sorts of people. But I think we should be trying to work now in this junction, which the left actually is quite irrelevant in Britain. It's been smashed. It's irrelevant in many parts of Europe and the rest of the Western world. We should be having strategic political alliances with people across the political spectrum. I've got no problem with that. And I think, actually, you touch on something very important, is that where we share commonalities, we should try to work with people. The important thing is, as a Muslim who's engaged in that political work, you just have to be very confident in your own belief system, and you have to be assertive in what you believe. And if they don't want to accept that, well, that's their problem.
Ms. Anne, let me bring you back in. Now, again, I want to ask you, because you know the left very well from past work that you've done. Just tell me, do you not feel as if there may be a case, examples that you've seen, of Muslims who are leaning more to left-wing politics and actually leaning away from Islam? I mean, for example, I worry that there may be sisters, for example, who are very politically active. They get caught up in socialist ideas and socialist thinkers, and they are moving away from concepts like they'll be anti-hijab, for example, but they'll be very pro-socialism, for example. And obviously the priority should be hijab here. So just tell me, have you ever seen this example? Is it something that you're concerned about at all?
I'm not sure if I can say if I've seen a large percentage or a growing percentage of Muslims leaning towards communism or atheism more. There are people from within our background who would identify themselves as communists or even atheists, but I can't comment on their religious practice prior to them joining these groups, because I frankly didn't know them back then. But what I can say is, firstly, like, communism and these kind of ideas, they're not just, you know, they're not just part of the Western world. A lot of them, there are Arab communists, you know, Arab atheists as well, Middle Eastern atheists as well, people from what we would call part and part of the Muslim world who have these ideas. I think if you have a strong religious foundation, a strong religious upbringing, if you are grounded in your religion and engaged in your religion, I think you will have a strong basis to at least theologically and philosophically counter those arguments while standing in solidarity with said groups on issues that we all agree with.
Amar, let me come back to you, because one thing which, again, I notice is that Islam has everything for us. As Muslims, we get everything from Islam. We don't need any other ideology, surely. I mean, there's this case of a popular trend of Muslims praising left-wing anti-imperialist heroes like Che Guevara and Fidel Castro. Now, I'm not saying that they don't deserve praise. Obviously, they did a good thing for their nations, for their people, for their movements. But, I mean, Islam, we have our own heroes. We don't need to aspire to be the next Fidel Castro. We've got our own bearded heroes, surely, that we should aspire to promote, to talk about, to try and live up to their example.
Well, I agree with that. And I think that part of the problem is that there are, in the 20th and 21st century, very few examples of successful Islamic resistance movements sort of pushing forward and taking state authority and even just, you know, being able to be influential in different states. There are some of them, of course, as we know. But for the most part, I suppose people tend to praise people like Fidel Castro and, you know, people like that because they have, you know, they're very recent examples of successful anti-imperialist action. And actually, I don't think that's necessarily a problem, because if the extent of that is joining a coalition that is trying to tackle two of the greatest threats and problems for Muslims geopolitically in the world today, which is the United States of America and the State of Israel, then I think we should be allied in that. In fact, if you look at someone like Hugo Chavez, he was completely counter to some of these militant atheists. He was a, you know, practicing Catholic himself. He was a very strong ally of Iran. He used to talk about Imam Mehdi. He used to understand that Islam is actually, you know, politically very anti-imperialist and an ally. So, you know, we don't have greats like Hugo Chavez with us today on the planet, but, you know, there are examples of actually different anti-imperialist leaders across the world coming together, understanding the importance of religion in liberation. You know, some people call that liberation theology. That's got a particular trend in certain countries in Latin America. And I don't see a problem with that. Obviously, Islam is comprehensive, but it doesn't mean that we can't look to inspiring and successful movements that have managed to do things that are not necessarily contradictory or incompatible with Islam.
For sure. Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. There's so much more we could have discussed, but unfortunately we are running out of time. So I'll have to say thank you to you, Amar, and thank you to Mizan as well for joining us. And thank you to everyone at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam, inshallah. But for now, salamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. In Britain, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, says he's ready to risk recession to bring inflation down. The Bank of England has said Britain will enter recession in the final quarter of this year, but is now looking to raise interest rates again in an effort to tackle inflation. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The website politico.eu has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, says he would throw his weight behind the Bank of England's monetary policies to tackle inflation, even if it means the country could plunge into recession. Jeremy Hunt made the remark during an interview with Britain's Sky News. On Friday, 26th of May, he said, "The only path to sustainable growth is to bring inflation under control." Asked if he was okay with further rate hikes, even if it could cause a recession, Jeremy Hunt said, "Yes, because in the end, inflation is a source of instability. It is not a trade-off between tackling inflation and recession." He added, If we want to have prosperity, to grow the economy, to reduce the risk of recession, we have to support the Bank of England in the difficult decisions that they take. The opposition Labour Party was quick to hit back, though. It said the government has no plans to restore growth. The Shadow Trade Secretary, Nick Thomas-Symonds, told Sky News, "No government should ever be content to see a recession. Frankly, this government has no credible plan to restore economic growth." The Bank of England has already raised the interest rate to tackle high inflation. Now it may raise it again as high as 5.5%. Inflation in the United Kingdom has slowed to 8.7% in April. However, food prices continue to surge at the fastest rate in over four decades. The country has been hit by numerous strikes over the worsening cost of living crisis. The British News of the Daily Mail has also covered the same story. The people of Britain are facing more interest rate pain after Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt backed the Bank of England tackling rampant inflation, even if it means plunging the country into recession. The Chancellor Jeremy Hunt delivered the tough message as he warned that getting spiralling prices under control is the only route to prosperity. Although recent official figures showed headline CPI inflation finally dropping into single figures, reflecting easing energy costs, the core rate actually rose, driven by surging food prices. Spooked markets have responded by hiking interest rate expectations, with a level now widely expected to reach 5.5%. There had previously been hopes that the current 4.5% would be the peak. Mortgage payers are already seeing the impact, with rates moving up. Jeremy Hunt said prioritising measures to slow rising prices was necessary, even if rate hikes damage the economy. He said, "I have to do something else, which is to make sure the decisions that I take as Chancellor, very difficult decisions to balance the books so that the markets, the world, can see that Britain is a country that pays its way. All these things mean that monetary policy at the Bank of England and fiscal policy by the Chancellor are aligned." Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has pledged to halve inflation this year, making the promise in January when the figure stood at 10.1%. The Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey said there is still a chance that the government will meet the pledge despite the challenges ahead. However, Threadneedle Street also conceded that its inflation forecasts have been significantly out and lessons must be learnt from the response. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, upgraded its growth forecast for the United Kingdom earlier this week, suggesting the economy will avoid a recession. But some experts believe it would not have been so optimistic if we had seen the inflation figures. The website House Price Cash has also covered the same story. The inflation pain being endured by the people of Britain was laid bare on Friday, 26th of May, with figures showing they're spending far more in the shops than before COVID, but getting less. Retail sales clawed back ground last month, with volumes, how much people buy, expanding by 0.5% after a grim March hit by bad weather. But the monthly improvement masked wider woe for consumers. While the value of retail sales, how much people spend, is up 16.5% since February of 2020, volumes are still 0.8% lower. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS numbers for April, revealed a limited recovery following a fall of 1.2% in volumes in March. The figure was higher than the 0.3% analysts had penciled in. Jewellers, sports retailers and department stores all reported stronger trade. However, The Office for National Statistics found sales volumes were down 3% on the same month last year, although shoppers spent more due to higher prices. Inflation figures earlier this week underlined the pressures on British consumers, although headline CPI inflation finally dropped into single figures, reflecting easing of energy costs, the core rate actually rose. The figures showed food price rises at 19.3%, down only slightly on March's eye-watering 19.6%. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. According to official data released recently, Britain's unemployment rate has increased over the first 3 months of the current year as skyrocketing inflation puts further pressure on the labour market. According to a report by the National Bureau of Statistics, the unemployment rate across the United Kingdom climbed from 3.8% during the three-month period ending in February to 3.9%. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, reacted to the new rise in unemployment rates, noting the pressure put on families to find jobs. Jeremy Hunt said, "Difficulty in finding staff and rising prices are a worry for many families and businesses. That's why we must stick to our plan to halve inflation and help families with the cost of living crisis, while delivering our childcare reforms and supporting older people and disabled people who want to work." The unemployment report followed recent official data showing Britain's economic output contracted for a second month in a row in April, weighed down by soaring consumer prices. Based on official data, the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, exceeded 10% in March. Inflation in Britain's grocery market has soared to a record high of 17.1%, hitting prices for milk and eggs the hardest in March. According to market researcher Kantar, this could increase the cost of a family's typical buying basket by £811 per year.
Economic Divide.
When it comes to banks, most people are mainly concerned with a couple of things. Can I get a loan? And the ability to withdraw their money. Well, in the U.S., these two have become serious issues for depositors, since U.S. bank failures are mounting. And while there has been a bank run, the U.S. government still refuses to acknowledge that there is a banking problem in that country. Hi, I'm Kavit Tafwe. Welcome to Economic Divide. Some of the highlights of this program. 4 bank closures in the U.S., many more are predicted. Tumbling bank shares as a result. One reason, rising interest rates. Next, taking a look at the banking crisis, well, deposits are falling, bank runs are happening on a more frequent basis. That is a major problem when you have runs, because then the money is being pulled out. And then the cost of keeping customers, that's on the rise, and for the banks are unable to maintain that cost. Next, the health of the U.S. economy as a whole. Rising interest rates, you have inflation, you have the banking crisis. That is obviously two signs that are not good. And then you have a debt ceiling, which may be solved, but still it points to a dark economic downturn for the U.S.
The U.S. is facing an economic crisis. Just weeks ago, J.P. Morgan Chase took over the troubled U.S. bank First Republic in a deal brokered by regulators. First Republic had been under pressure since last month when the collapse of two other U.S. lenders sparked fears about the state of the banking system. The failure of the San Francisco-based First Republic is the second largest in U.S. history and the third in the country since March. It was ranked as the 14th largest lender in the U.S. at the end of last year. Problems in the banking sector surfaced in the U.S. earlier last month when Silicon Valley Bank, which was the country's 16th largest lender, collapsed in the biggest failure of a U.S. bank since 2008. That was followed 2 days later by the failure of New York's Signature Bank. Meanwhile, the U.S. Federal Reserve has revealed that over 700 banks reported unrealized losses exceeding 50% of their capital at the end of the third quarter of 2022. Authorities say rising interest rates are creating significant unrealized losses in investment securities and, in some cases, depressing tangible equity.
Americans can rest assured that our banking system is safe. Your deposits are safe. Let me also assure you we will not stop at this. We'll do whatever is needed.
The U.S. Fed Chair Jerome Powell has insisted the U.S. banking system is sound and resilient, but many have expressed concerns that the U.S. banking crisis is not over and a much worse financial crisis is coming.
Time now for our social media post. First up, U.S. banks sitting on $1.7 trillion in unrealized losses. These losses are not yet reflected on the balance sheets. A study shows that many banks' assets lost 10% of their value this year due to rising interest rates. The current state of the U.S. banking system is fragile and could be at risk of a crisis. This could have a ripple effect on the financial system as a whole. Next, we went to a website, and this is about the amount of money that's being withdrawn. April 17, 2023, depositors pulled nearly $60 billion from three U.S. banks as Apple raises pressure. Next, we go to another date, April 1st, where this website said depositors yanked another $126 billion from U.S. banks, where it said that the depositors to have drained another $126 billion from U.S. banks during the week ending March 22nd. And this was sourced from the new Federal Reserve data. This time, the outflow came from the nation's largest institutions. And finally, three failed U.S. banks had one thing in common. It's called the KPMG. Big Four auditors work for SVB, Signature Bank, and First Republic comes under scrutiny in the aftermath of the collapse. Let's break this down based on this entry. The trio of bank failures since March has cast a pall over this KPMG's lucrative business as the largest auditor of the U.S. banking sector. In all three cases, KPMG gave the bank's financial statements a clean bill of health as recently as the end of February. So that's obviously not a good sign if the regulator is doing that. All right, let me introduce our guest for this section of the program. First, we have Paul Craig Roberts. He's a former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury who joins us. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to Economic Divide. When we take a look at what has happened, you have emergency meetings that are taking place. You have central banks offering credit lifelines. You have tumbling bank shares. These are all alarm bells that should be going off. Well, question is, why are U.S. banks in trouble? It is also said that aside from the ones that have failed, many more are on the horizon.
Yes, the banks are in trouble. And the reason is, or the visible reason, the most visible reason, is the rise in interest rates. And the reason that the rise in interest rates caused the bank trouble is that for 10 years, a decade, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, kept the interest rates very, very low, practically zero. And in real terms, the rates were negative. And so the assets that banks purchased for investments, such as U.S. Treasury bonds, these assets are now depreciated by the rise in interest rates. When interest rates rises, the price of existing bonds falls. So the situation for the banks is that their assets have all been pushed down in value by the rise in interest rates, but their liabilities have not. So their liabilities now exceed their assets, and the banks are technically insolvent.
Wow, not a good condition that these banks are in based on that explanation by Paul Craig Roberts. Next up is our other guest, John Diamond. He joins us. He's the director of the Center for Public Finance at Rice University's Baker Institute. John Diamond, welcome to Economic Divide. As to why this is happening now, that's what we're trying to get at, and hopefully you can answer us. But based on the research we've done, the turmoil is part of the fallout after central banks, including in the U.S. and in the U.K., raised interest rates sharply. That's what our guest also said, where it started last year. And they did that to try to dampen down the rising prices. But is that the only reason, these rising interest rates, for the banks to fail?
I mean, that is the reason. These banks had invested in what they considered to be a very safe asset, a U.S. Treasury. They did not foresee such a large rise in interest rates. So they didn't buy or they didn't manage the risk, the interest rate risk that's associated with those bonds correctly. Once the Fed started raising rates, that insurance became prohibitively expensive, or at least was expensive enough that they didn't get it right away. And so, yeah, the Fed raising interest rates was the major factor. Obviously, had the banks, you know, managed the risk a little better, then they wouldn't be facing such significant losses.
Time now for our InfoNews section of the program, where we have four news items with an economic flavor that we present to you. First up, something that's happening in the U.S. which is of grave concern, and that's U.S. bankruptcies. Big firms are filing for bankruptcy left and right, and it's just the beginning based on the source that we picked for this. The filings have laid bare just how exposed highly indebted firms are, and this comes in the wake of, guess what, interest rate hikes. It said that data from Moody's and S&P Global suggests the pain could just be getting underway and could last all this year. All right, this is a great achievement that's happening between Iran and Russia in terms of an achievement, and it regards a railway. Moscow and Tehran signed a key rail deal. The new route will help diversify international trade flows. The construction involves a rail line between the Iranian cities of Rasht and then Astara. The cost, it comes in at $1.6 billion. Also, along the lines of Russia-Iran trade, this would be about the economy of both countries to benefit from this. Russia's second largest bank, VTB, opened a branch here in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this, in a sense, also points to de-dollarization of both countries. Now, this concerns China and West Asia in terms of the trade that's happening between the two, which is important in terms of the data. In the year 2021, trade between the countries of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, or the GCC, and then China surpassed that of the United States and Europe for the first time. And the source of that particular piece of data was the IMF, and attributed this to Beijing's pro-growth policies and West Asian region ambitious economic transformation programs. So that's that just shows how Asia as a whole and its trade relations with countries in West Asia, where we are, is progressing at a rapid pace. Next up, something that's happened in Turkey. And, of course, it's not about the elections, but it's election-related vis-a-vis its economy. Now, we know that the runoff is going to take place. When you watch this program, it may have taken place already. But in terms of Turkey's stock index, it fell after the election stalemate that happened, which it was rallying because many thought that Erdogan would actually lose. But in terms of the bets that were against Erdogan, well, obviously that failed, which shows that you cannot count Erdogan out. Many are predicting now that he will actually win in the runoff. Well, those were the, I guess, news with the economic flavor that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section. When it comes to banks, the depositors or customers don't care about anything except for one issue. Can they get their money out of the bank whenever they want? In other words, this is the question that we pose. Are U.S. banks safe overall? That is the focus of this in-depth section. Okay, first, let's get down to some basic facts about banking. Now, surprisingly, many don't realize that when it comes to their money and when it is deposited in a bank, well, a legal fact is that the money deposited there is actually a loan that you make to your bank for which you earn interest. The bank actually takes your money and loans it to others and makes money based upon the differential in interest rates as well as fees. Many don't know that. Then we go to this fact. If the bank is on shaky financial ground, and of course your money is sitting in that bank and it goes into things like bad loans, well, this ultimately becomes the problem of the creditor. That means you, the individual. But how is that possible, you may ask? You may say, well, it's my money and I should be able to withdraw it at any time. Yet, that is hardly the case. I want to tell you why. Here comes another term, which again, a majority are not familiar with, particularly in the U.S. What is it called? It's called a bail-in. Definition and how it affects the rights of a depositor. Well, bail-in is another form where banks and financial institutions are rescued, where the responsibility is transferred from the taxpayers, in the case of a bailout, to the depositors. And that's you in this case, okay? Now, here's the important part. A bail-in will not actually add to the government's deficit. How, you may ask? Well, it will allow banks and financial institutions at risk of failing to take some of your deposits to bail themselves out. Did you get that? Very good. Next, how will a bail-in then likely happen? Well, with the U.S. economy heading towards some negative factors, such as a possible recession or the inflation, which is at an all-time high, and then the housing market, which is in a bubble, well, uncertainties are looming over the head of Americans. And one clear sign of all of this, U.S. banks going bankrupt as they have been. Okay, let's get more on this. Let me bring back our guest, Paul Craig Roberts, who's a former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, rejoins us. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome back. Given the negative news on U.S. banks and the bank failures that we've been covering, we're looking at around $200 billion in bank runs that's happened so far. Is the U.S. going to face an even larger bank run, do you think? And would that lead to many bank closures? And what can the depositors do to stop that happening or preventing them from withdrawing their money, do you think?
For two reasons, depositors are withdrawing their money from the banks. Well, the way the banks have to provide the money to the depositors is to sell the assets. But the assets are depreciated, so they're not getting the amount of money that they need. And so they are all in a mess. And I think it will continue because I suspect that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury are encouraging bank failure in order that there can be more concentration in the banking system. In other words, when a bank gets in trouble, then the large banks, the banks too big to fail, they purchase that bank. And so we see growing monopolization of the banking system.
Wow, that's a very interesting point that he's making there. Let's find out what John Diamond thinks. We'll bring him back in, director of the Center for Public Finance at Rice University's Baker Institute. John Diamond, welcome back. When you take a look at the health of the U.S. economy, we'd like to find out from you how it's doing. You have a banking crisis, you have the debt ceiling problem, which probably is going to get solved, but nevertheless, even if we don't see the total breakdown in trust when it comes to things like banking deposits that are being made, we could still see how the economy is not doing well, taking a look at the bank closures, especially in things like maybe unwillingness to lend at this point. How severe an impact do these closures have on the U.S. economy?
So it's going to have a big impact. We've already seen banks pulling back on their ability or willingness to lend credit. Moving forward, how tight credit gets in the U.S. is going to depend on what happens with future interest rates, as well as what happens with this debt ceiling crisis. If the U.S. Congress and the president come to an agreement and we get this crisis behind us relatively soon, then I think we will avoid any large problems. We will just face a relatively small cost in terms of there's been a hesitancy to lend with this uncertainty on the horizon. If we push this right up to the deadline, those costs get larger the closer we get to that deadline, as credit, the cost of credit default swaps and other contracts are having to be unwound behind the scenes. If we go past the deadline without a deal, then all bets are off and we could return to something similar to a 2008 style crisis in which the whole system starts to unravel.
The banking crisis is not the only problem the U.S. is facing. As the national debt has soared, the U.S. Treasury Department has had to borrow more money to pay for government spending. The legislative curb on this borrowing is known as the debt ceiling. When the Treasury Department spends the maximum amount authorized under the ceiling, Congress must vote to suspend or raise the limit on borrowing. Economists are warning of dire consequences, including a default, if Congress cannot reach an agreement on the ceiling. In January 2023, the total national debt and the debt ceiling both stood at $31.4 trillion. The U.S. government has run a deficit averaging nearly $1 trillion every year since 2001, meaning that it spends that much more money than it receives in taxes and other revenues. Economists warn that a lengthy default could send the American economy into a deep recession with soaring unemployment while destabilizing a global financial system built on U.S. bonds. Investors are bracing for impact, although any debt non-payment would likely be temporary. An analysis by Biden's economic advisors has warned that even a brief default would cost the U.S. economy 500,000 jobs at a minimum. They believe a protracted default would send GDP plunging by 6%, with the loss of tens of thousands of businesses and some 8.3 million jobs when it's all over, almost as many as during the 2008 financial crisis.
A default would threaten the gains that we've worked so hard to make over the past few years in our pandemic recovery, and it would spark a global downturn that would set us back much further. It would also risk undermining U.S. global economic leadership and raise questions about our ability to defend our national security interests.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apostian. U.S. bank failures have raised the alarm on a number of fronts, both within and outside the U.S. In the case of SVB, Silicon Valley bank. The former chief executive said he was unaware that the bank was in trouble when he sold stock weeks before it failed. SVB's downfall was triggered by holdings of long-term treasuries losing value as interest rates rose quickly, a risk the bank had not hedged. The bank tried to cover the loss by raising capital, but in announcing the transaction helped fuel a bank run.
We know your banks were fatally mismanaged. The next obvious question is why? Why did you let things get this bad? Why did you ignore admonitions from regulators?
Mr. Becker, you made a really stupid bet that went bad, didn't you?
Senator?
And the taxpayers of America had to pick up the tab for your stupidity, didn't they?
Senator, there were a series of events, unprecedented events that occurred that led us to where we are today.
No, this wasn't unprecedented. This was bone deep, down to the marrow, stupid.
When it comes to First Republic, the former chief executive, Michael Roeffler, blamed the bank's collapse on the contagion from the failures of other regional banks and said regulators did not express concerns regarding the bank's strategy, liquidity, or management performance. A total of over $100 billion in deposits were withdrawn from the bank over the course of weeks in response to an industry-wide panic about the soundness of regional banks.
First Republic's financial position and strategy were regularly reviewed by our regulators, the California DFPI and the FDIC.
His comments on the speed of the collapse, Silicon Valley and Signature Banks were quite interesting.
No one at First Republic could have predicted the collapse of Silicon Valley and Signature, the speed at which it happened, or the impact it had on the banking industry. Instead of dealing with temporary decreased earnings due to interest rate pressures, First Republic was contaminated overnight by the contagion that spread from the unprecedented failures of those banks.
That does it for this Quick Tech section. Please send us your comments or questions. We would really appreciate it.
So, is there a banking crisis in the U.S.? I mean, on the one hand, let me come up actually with you with this question. If there was a banking crisis, do you think U.S. officials and authorities would actually make that announcement that there is one, which would risk more of a bank run? I mean, the same applies to its economy. At the heart of the U.S. economy, there is a heartbeat, but it's a weak one, from colossal debt to weak economic growth, and of course, you then have runaway inflation. They're trying to control it, but it's been a difficult task. We leave it up to you to judge whether the U.S. economy is doing well as a whole, and of course, the banking problem, whether there is one or not. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in to us, and we hope you liked it. From Mikovit Thakway and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
President Biden and Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy have reached an agreement in principle to raise the debt ceiling. But the House and Senate still have to approve the legislation before the government runs out of money, which could happen as soon as 5th of June. We take a